This is Tea Earl Grey Heart, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. Justice. Hello and welcome to episode number 41 of Tea Earl Grey Heart, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. My name is Dave, and I'm joined this week by someone who, allowing for different house flooring levels, is approximately 928 metres closer to the stars than I am. Oh. It's my good friend over in the in Switzerland. It's Yannick. Hi, Yannick.
Hi, hello, how are you, Dave?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well indeed.
So how did you come up with this difference of altitudes?
I realised that you being in Switzerland, you're in a very mountainous country. Me being literally in the valley of a river, I figured there was quite a big difference. So I actually went on, I can't even remember the website was. I started on Wikipedia and looked up your town name, and it had an elevation. And then I looked up my town name, and it didn't. So I then went to the bigger town, and it didn't. And then I went to the even bigger city, and it, so I found a website that if you click on a location on the map, it tells you exactly how far above sea level it is. You are 1,011 metres above sea level. And when I say you, I mean your house, because I know where you live. and my house is 83 metres above sea level.
Interesting.
So you're almost a kilometre closer to the nearest star than I am.
Which makes all the difference.
It certainly does. Yeah. It's not at light speed, but it certainly does.
Yeah. I'm also closer to the sun, so probably that's the reason why it's warmer here.
Well, I tell you what, outside at the moment is, well, I don't know if it is at the moment because I can't see, but it has been piddling it down with rain all day. Yeah. It's horrible. Absolutely horrible. But to say how warm it was yesterday. And apparently we're going to be getting grotty weather for, like, until next week.
Oh, right, yeah, so here too. Until the end of this week, it's horrible. I gave up the idea of mowing my lawn this week.
Anyway, as much as the weather is a very exciting topic of conversation, we are not here to discuss the weather. On this week's show, we're going to be reviewing Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 1, Episode 8, Justice. We're going to have a discussion on fiction versus reality, and I do believe there is a thank you that needs to be made.
Yes, there is.
So, if you are ready, we shall crack on then with our review of The Next Generation, Season 1, Episode 8, Justice. So, in the teaser, we are presented with a log entry from Captain Picard. After delivering a party of Earth colonists to the Strand solar system, we have discovered another M-class planet in the adjoining Rubicon star system. We are now in orbit there, having determined it to be inhabited, as well as unusually lovely. My first officer has taken an away team down to make contact, and they are in the process of returning to the ship. Unusually lovely is an unusual thing for Picard to say.
Yes. Yes. It goes with the planet, though.
It but does.
We don't it know does. That yet.
No. But, and this is why I just found it really, really weird language from Picard that he would describe anything as lovely.
Yes.
But, yeah, as we see later on. Upon his return back from the surface, Commander Riker tells everyone with great enthusiasm about the planet. He explains that the planet's life forms are almost identical to humans, and that it is a Class M planet, beautiful and stunning. Dr. Crusher suggests shore leave for everyone, stating that nothing is better than fresh air and open spaces.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Well, there are a few things on that planet that are better than fresh air and open spaces. Lieutenant Natasha Yar states that the inhabitants' laws and customs are pretty straightforward and nothing out of the ordinary. What is special about them, however, says Geordie LaForge, is their great affection for others.
Yeah,
not the phrase I would have used.
That's an understatement.
Sorry, I do apologise. We are spoiling this as we go because it's
so funny.
It deserves it.
Yeah.
Commander Data reports on a continuing faulty reading in the sensors, indicating that there is something in orbit, despite the fact that nothing appears on the view screen. The Doctor's suggestion of shore leave is approved, but only for a small group at first. Among them is Wesley Crusher, whom the captain personally designates as the one to evaluate this planet as a place for young people to relax. If their scans and observations support the report from the away team, then shore leave for the entire crew will be approved, says Picard. He just hopes the planet is not too good to be true. And I'm thinking, nothing about this looks good. Don't get me wrong, it appears good, but that means it's not good.
Yeah.
At least that's how I felt at the time.
We haven't seen the planet yet, if I remember correctly.
No, but I think at this point, bearing in mind, this is the teaser, the credits have just started rolling. Looking at how Riker and Yar and LaForge have come back with grins on their faces, they look as if they're either stoned or brainwashed. And I'm thinking, this just sounds incredibly wrong. There's something wrong here. It's not what it seems.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it felt strange too that he would send Wesley. I understand that, you know, he wants to assess the possibility to send children on the planet, but I immediately thought, I know who's going to get in trouble.
Yes. Yeah. I totally get why Picard sent him down there. Not least of which, because he obviously didn't understand what was on the planet.
Yeah. But, we're going to talk about that after the next scene.
Yes, let's get some actual some content done, because otherwise we're kind of discussing things that nobody else knows what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So then, on to Act 1. Commander Riker, Lieutenant Yar, Lieutenant Worf, Wesley, and Counselor Deanna Troi beam down to the surface, where they are passionately greeted and welcomed. Two of the planet's inhabitants, Revan and Lyata, introduce themselves by hugging everyone in turn. Worf compliments them on their planet and rather uncomfortably accepts their hugs and affections. Wesley isn't sure how to take them and how to react. Overall, these aliens are warm, empathetic, and seem to have thought of everything. Suiting to their fit and joyous lifestyle, people do not walk anywhere, but run along and jog. They wish everyone health and happiness, even passers-by as they run to the council chamber. When they arrive, three children take Wesley to play right away, while the adults enter the chamber to find more of a massage parlour where people are playing games, dancing, exercising, receiving massages, hugging and kissing.
Yeah. So why would they run? Why would the happy people spend their time running instead of walking? I have no idea.
I don't know. I don't know. But it seems to me they do need a lot of energy where they are for various reasons. But
sure.
Having just dropped onto that planet for the first time, because I think Worf was the only one that hadn't been on there in the previous...
Wesley wasn't it?
No, I'm not including him at the moment, but yeah.
Troi neither.
Oh, so Troi hadn't been down either. Right, that's fine. I can certainly see how beaming down into that and suddenly being smothered by affection and physical contact and sensuous... touching would be incredibly awkward and probably quite disorientating for somebody who just wasn't expecting it.
Yeah. Yar was very pleased to come back.
Yep. Yeah, she seems to be happy to be there.
Yeah, yeah. So back to Wesley being here. Yar and Riker were there on the planet before. How come Riker let Wesley come to this planet? It doesn't seem like a place for children. I don't know. It seems something that people under 18 or 21 should not be allowed. But I don't know.
I totally get where you're coming from, and I do agree with you. However, you have to appreciate the role of children is both essential and inevitable.
Yeah.
because they are a very touchy-feely race.
yes.
the appearance of children is going to happen. There's no question about that at all.
It's a byproduct.
Literally. But I don't know. I think Riker could have done a better job of actually informing Wesley what he was getting into.
And the
but
captain.
The captain didn't know.
No, but Riker should have informed the captain a little bit more than what he said.
Yeah, I do agree. But if there are kids on the surface, and I would find it very unlikely that the kids are engaging in the same activities as the adults are, then actually it's probably a good place for Wesley to be.
Yes, but
you pack Wesley off with the rest of the kids and they're out of the way, so the adults can get on with, well, whatever.
But sending Wesley in such an environment without even telling her mother what to expect, and maybe she would have, you know, she wouldn't have agreed to that. So
yeah, no, I get that. I get that.
Well, you know, as I said, someone had to get in trouble, so why not Wesley?
Yes, and get in trouble he does. Do you not think that the Enterprise crew kind of stick out like a sore thumb at the moment because they are incredibly overdressed?
Yes,
for the rest of the natives,
but the rest of them are, you know, incredibly underdressed.
Yes, most definitely.
Yeah, yeah. I hope it's always warm on this planet.
That's a good point. That was never mentioned.
No.
I know we were talking about the weather earlier, but I don't remember it in the episode at all. Nope. The dialogue in that first scene was pretty good, actually. It was very, very cleverly done. When Riker asked Troy what she was sensing from the planet, and she said, it's only healthy sensuality, sir. I feel mainly friendship and happiness, she said. Obviously, she didn't want to say what it was that she was actually feeling from the person that had just given her a rather personal hug.
I thought she was looking at Yar when she said that.
No. No, it was definitely... Well, she said healthy sensuality, sir.
Yeah, so that's from the inhabitants of the planet. But when she said happiness, she turned and looked at Yar and smiled.
Oh, right. Okay, yes. Yes, but she was responding to something that Riker had said.
Yeah.
And then there was Worf, completely and totally out of place, very awkward, received an incredibly, a very pleasant-looking hug from, trying to remember her name now, Reven. Yeah. And his response was, nice planet. Oh, fantastic. And there was one more as well. When they were jogging their way towards the council chambers, Riker looked around and said to Worf, "When in Rome, huh?" And Worf went, "When in where?"
Yeah. And no idea. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. So, yeah, good start so far. Meanwhile, aboard the Enterprise-D, Data has completed his analysis. None of the internal systems are at fault. The reading, although mysterious, is accurate. It appears to be some sort of shadow, like something that is neither in nor out of their dimension. When the main viewer is not showing anything out there, Data hails the empty space, requesting that it identify itself. What, the empty space?
Yeah.
Suddenly, a strange object appears, and the ship enters automatic red alert. What's that?
Absolutely.
It looks like a space station.
Yeah.
Of sorts.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it kind of looked like the caretaker, which is the entity that sends Voyager at the other side of the galaxy, but to the other side of the galaxy.
Okay.
It was weird. And what is weirder is Data hailing the entity without even asking Picard, or without Picard asking anything. So
was interesting.
It was strange.
Yeah, it does seem unusual that he would have taken it on himself to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe he thought that because Picard had asked him to, you know, carry out analysis, do some investigation work, that he felt that was part of it. He never got picked up on it.
No. I would like to say hello to Lainey, who has joined us in the YouTube chat room. Hello, Lainey.
Good evening, Lainey. It says there are two people in there, but the other one might be me.
Okay. So, hello, Dave.
Hello. See, I'm lucky because I can actually respond in person. Hello, overuse of Dave. Privilege, I think. So then, on to Act 2 already.
Mm-hmm.
The sensor readings do not make any sense, and the response to their transmission is difficult to decode. When LaForge looks out of the window in the observation lounge with his visor, he experiences the same confusion. It's as if what he's seeing is not really there. Data, however, is finally able to make out something, stating that the message that they are receiving translates as something like, "Stand by." Then a small, transparent, ball-like object exits the entity and passes right through Enterprise's hull, moving through corridors and bulkheads.
Yeah, and people acting in the corridors when they see this thing pass through the walls. But it was not the worst extra acting. It was a bit weird, but not the worst we've seen.
No, it wasn't. I actually felt there was some decent acting in mm-hmm. the interaction with the ball, because where obviously people are looking into an empty space in front of them and they're not seeing it. Mm-hmm. Either they've done a good job of keeping the ball in line with where the actors are looking, or the actors have done a good job of being told to look where they of looking where they've been told to.
Yeah.
So it didn't look out of place at all, as you would expect it from sort of late 1980s special effects.
Yeah. Kudos to the extras.
Yeah, definitely. Don't say that often.
Nope.
The shimmering ball of light makes its way to the bridge and then rocks the entire ship as it speaks. Captain Picard speaks with it, explaining, between the shakes of the ship, who he is, and that he is on a mission of peaceful exploration. It then demands to know why they have come to visit. Picard explains that they have sent an away team to make peaceful contact, and he does not plan on leaving life forms there. The entity asks about the colony they have just planted, and Picard explains the process of terraforming, and that they would only do it for uninhabited worlds. The entity gives a warning not to interfere with its children below on the planet, and then tries to communicate with Data, seemingly telepathically. Data then says, "I do not understand how, but it's asking me if I was constructed for information interchange." Picard encourages him to go along with it, the object then communicating directly with Data, who falls unconscious.
Yeah, that was a nice fall. I don't know if it was Brent Spiner or
amazing piece of acting, because it's as if he just went.
Yeah.
There was no hesitation. There was no sort of looking back as if to say, you know, am I going to hit something on the way down? So it could have been the stunt person, but
yeah, probably.
I don't know.
But kudos to the stunt person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have enough kudos to give around?
Yeah, I have plenty. Sorry. You know, it's been like one season of Enterprise and worth of kudos that we haven't distributed. So. how can something, whether an entity or else, can communicate telepathically with data? I mean, it doesn't have brain waves of or those things that we think could be used for telepathy. So I don't know. Maybe it's got a Wi-Fi access point somewhere. I don't know.
Well, I think that is the data equivalent of telepathy, isn't it? It's radio waves,
Bluetooth.
Well, slightly off shade of yellow tooth. But it was very weird. Yeah. My question is more to the fact that how on earth could the ball entity penetrate the ship's shields? Because the shields were up.
Yeah, but it's half there, half not there in the same, you know, it's in, both in and out of our 3D dimensions, so I guess.
But that's cheating.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine.
So what?
Yeah, it's not as if it's real. Ooh, sorry.
What? Star Trek is not real. How dare you?
Didn't say that.
Gene Roddenberry would be ashamed of your remark.
I am so sorry. I know it is real. Down on the planet, Wesley is running through the gardens with a few of the Edo children, when one of them starts walking on their hands. Wesley responds by spinning a few cartwheels, as you do. One of the girls runs up to him and says she would like to do something with him, something that he could teach her. Wesley is clearly flustered, claiming that there are some games he doesn't quite know yet. Oh, brilliant line, love it.
Yeah.
But she's talking about playing ball, which quite visibly puts him at ease. He asks the other children if they have a bat, but they're quite confused by what that is. Wesley explains to them that it's a stick or branch. So they all run to the further into the gardens to try and find one.
Yes.
That was so awkward.
Yeah. Yes, but it was not badly played. I mean, it was actually kind of good acting.
It was, but I think that scene was actually developed specifically for the purpose of us, the viewer, completely get them at the wrong end of the stick, no pun intended, because we'd already seen what the adults were like. We were obviously assuming that that's what the kids were going to be like, but actually the kids were just being kids.
Yeah.
You know, the innocence of youth, the lass that ran over to Wesley, you know, you could tell that he was quite taken by her. So he was like, are you asking me things that I'm not supposed to know about yet? But no, no.
Nope.
She wasn't.
No, yeah. Whoever was in charge of Wesley's wardrobe should once again be fired because of his pants, brown and red. Well, it reminded me of this of the sweater he had a couple of episodes ago that we fired the person in charge of the wardrobe at the time. So I don't know if it was the same person, then definitely it should be fired, or if it's another one, which, you know, should find another way to make money.
Well, he seems to wear that same outfit quite a few times, and I'm wondering whether that's the uniform he's supposed to wear when he's on the bridge. Because the last time he was on the bridge, when he was sat to the left of Troy on the support structure in the command area of the bridge, he was wearing exactly the same outfit or style of outfit.
Yeah,
so I don't know whether that's Beverly, his acting.
Maybe Beverly before. Just brought two sweaters and two pants, and that's it.
I suppose. I don't know how often do they do laundry on the Enterprise.
Do they even do laundry, or do they replicate new clothes?
Oh, now that's a very good point.
and then recycle the rest.
What?
So we were back to what we asked earlier. What are they doing with everything that has been replicated, like plates and cups and cutlery and things like that? We don't know.
No. Maybe they just phaser them out of existence and then just generate new ones.
They throw everything in the warp core.
But powered by dilithium crystals and clay. But I don't know. You can't make something out of nothing. There has to be something there to make something out of. So even the replicators must have some form of substance, you know, like 3D printer filament, for example. There has to be a starting material, a starting matter, which either they would have to then recycle from the things that they're disposing of, or I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe we're thinking too much about that.
It's one of those things that we need to get an answer to. We know we're not going to get an answer to.
Yeah.
But it's still going to keep cropping up again and again and again.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, live with it, you know. Talking of living with it. Worf is extremely uncomfortable with the advances of the women, avoiding them as much as he can. He's not much concerned with pleasure, according to himself, as he is a warrior. Plus, he is convinced that these women couldn't handle his Klingon mating habits. Yes, Riker accuses Worf. Riker said he would have accused Worf of bragging about his mating habits had it not been Worf.
Yeah,
which I thought was a very good save from Riker.
That was a very funny, quote from Riker.
Yeah. When Riker fails to contact Enterprise, he gets nervous and orders everyone together, including Wesley, just in case. Troy doesn't believe it's anything these people have done, since they are much too open and friendly. Nevertheless, Riker has Troy head outside with him to look for Wesley. And I'll say again, the number of instances where Wesley is still being referred to as the boy is getting a little bit tiresome now.
Yeah.
You know, he's a boy.
Even Worf, when Riker says, we need to find Wesley, Worf responded, Wesley, the boy?
Yes.
After a while, it becomes too much.
Yeah, it does. Now, during that scene, when Riker was walking through it before he met up with Worf, we walked amongst the crowds and there were lots of oohs, lots of ahs, lots of gyrating bodies. Would this program not have been broadcast during prime time? So during family broadcasting times?
Yes, I wondered about that.
All right, I'm 40, what am I, 40, how old am I? 48 years old. And even I found that uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, I don't know how they got away with that. It would be interesting to have, maybe to look on Google if that episode was censored or pushed back to a later time or maybe, you know, maybe not shown in some countries. But yeah, it's 87 at the time?
It would have been, yeah. November 87.
Yeah. I don't know if the US were already 110% politically correct on TV at this time. But I'm pretty sure there are some countries that wouldn't broadcast such an episode.
Yeah, it does make you wonder. I can't see any notes on the Memory Alpha article about that particular episode, but there may be some bits of trivia about this particular episode kicking around somewhere. We'll have a look at some point.
Yep.
Yar, who is just fascinated by the Edo, is talking with Riven and Lyeta about their laws as Worf approaches to brief her on the situation. They explain to her that there is no crime in their world and that no one breaks the laws. A long time ago, there was much disorder, but no longer. They explain that they have no police or law enforcement, but instead have so-called mediators, who select only one area each day for a certain period of time, the punishment zone. It's a completely random selection. No person ever knows when or where a zone will be, and so no one risks death.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
So, how come Yar pretends that she studied the laws and never got to learn that? I mean, that's pretty much the only law and punishment there is. So,
well, the laws and punishment don't necessarily go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Because the laws of the land are literally thou shalt or thou shalt not. But in terms of the punishments, it's more of a case of otherwise this will happen. And they don't necessarily sit in the same book. Certainly in this country, because sentencing is a separate kettle of fish to statute. So,
yeah,
I kind of get it from Yar's perspective, having gone through and studied all the laws and what the laws are and what the rules are. But it's just possible she may never actually studied the punishments, particularly if there's only one of them.
Well, if there's only one of them, and really not a lot of laws, except you know, don't do stupid things because of this random zone at random times, then surely everything should fit on, you know, two pages. So, yeah, I thought it was strange that she suddenly discovered that there is actually no crime and that there is one punishment. So,
you can understand why there is no crime.
Yeah.
If there is no punishment, if everything that has a law is subject to this one punishment, I'd behave as well.
Yeah, and the random punishment zone at random times, it could actually be pretty good, pretty efficient system.
It could be, but you'd still have people trying to game the system.
Yeah, well,
by finding out
after a while. Yeah, you mean, yeah.
By actually finding out where the particular location is and trying their luck. That will be the new thrill seeking. You know, forget roller coasters and like it'd be like going to these punishment zones.
And risking death? I wouldn't. I know I wouldn't.
I wouldn't go to a roller coaster and risk death. It's the same thing for me.
If they were telling us that, you know, we're going to select a random road and a random period of time, and if anyone is caught driving too fast on this road, then that's going to be punished by death. I would probably behave and respect all the speed limits on every road.
Are you saying you don't at the moment?
I cannot confirm or infirm.
Nice. Good save. The Edo explain to Worf and Yar, who are both very disturbed by this news, that there is only one punishment for any crime, death. While it sounds drastic, the Edo consider it very wise and a basis for their lasting peace. After all, since no one would want to risk execution, no one breaks the rules. Hearing this, the two officers are immediately alarmed and head off to find Wesley quickly, who they know is running around with the other kids, not knowing anything about these rules.
Yeah, why suddenly they're curious about Wesley? I mean, they don't know what Troy and Riker are doing. Maybe Troy and Riker could walk on the grass while looking for Wesley, but their only concern was Wesley.
Yes, but I think with Troy and Riker, they would have had the prime directive literally chiseled into their minds.
Yeah.
So the prime directive would automatically, I'm not going to say prevent them, but certainly dissuade them from interfering in any of the local laws.
That's
although,
true.
Although it did bring to mind the question of whether public decency is classified as a law on that planet.
Apparently not.
Apparently not, yes. But no, I think the point about not being told the rules is a very good one. You know, if I was to visit another workplace that I'd not been to before, well, obviously I'm not at the moment because we're all locked down, the first thing that would happen when I got introduced, signed in, and passed over to whoever was hosting me that day, I would get a health and safety briefing. Yeah. Where are the fire exits? What happens if the fire alarm goes off? Things to be aware of. And I would have thought that if you're going to another planet, the first thing you would want to find out is, does this place have any odd rules that are going to trip us up?
Which is what Yara was supposed to determine. But
you would have thought so, yeah.
But again, the Edo should have warned them, especially if the only punishment for any kind of transgression is death. I mean, surely you would warn your visitors.
I suppose, no, because you're right. But how often do they have visitors? That's the first thing to consider, because if they don't have many visitors, there may be no need to.
Yeah, it might even be the first ones.
Precisely. But also, if your way of life, the laws that you live by, and the punishments to which you adhere are the norm for you, you might automatically assume that they're the norm for everyone else. So
yeah, okay.
There's no need to tell anybody about something that is life for you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I agree.
As Riker said, when in Rome.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do as the Romans do. So.
So that comes down to who is responsible for. Getting informed. Is it the visitors who have to seek out what kind of laws and safety procedures and things like that are in place, or is it the host's responsibilities?
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to say this, but actually, I agree with you. This sits with Yar.
Yeah,
because as security chief, she already took the time to learn about their laws.
Yeah.
It would have been on her as well to find out what the punishments for breaching those laws were as well.
Yeah, I think I remember what she said when she came back on the Enterprise. I think she said that those people, they make love at the drop of a hat, of any hat. So did she really spend time studying the laws, or did she do something else?
I forgot about that one.
Yeah, yeah. So, given that she was very happy to come back and to hug whoever she hugged when she came back, I am not sure she really studied the laws.
Yes, it was Laeta that she hugged when she got back.
Mm-hmm.
Which, it all valid arguments, I think. But yeah, I think on this is on Yar. So we're on to Act 3. As the rest of the away team go looking for Wes before he's able to get any trouble that could be bad for him, unfortunately, they are too late. While Wesley is playing ball, he jumps for it in midair, crashing into a small greenhouse structure past a short white bar, disturbing the new plants within. And what's worse, the mediators picked that moment to show up. Everyone attempts to cover for him, pleading that he is only a visitor and did not know. But the mediators are adamant and insist on applying the law equally to everyone to avoid chaos, crime, and disobedience. Now, what was important about that white bar, I'm very surprised it wasn't mentioned earlier in the review, actually, but I do recall when they were talking about the punishment zones.
Yes.
They were talking about these white fences and these white bars that if basically you do not cross them.
Yes.
So to be fair, I don't think it would have made a difference whether Wesley had actually landed fully inside that greenhouse or whether he'd just knocked into it and caused no damage. He still would have been subject to the same punishment for crossing that bar.
Yeah. And so the mediators just arrived at this moment. I had a feeling that they had some kind of alarm or something, and then they show up because of Wesley falling in this greenhouse of sorts.
See, that makes sense.
Yeah. It's kind of like in The Prisoners. The prisoner, when every time he tries to escape, there's this bubble coming up. It's not that it was there before. It's just that it pops up when he tries to escape. And I think it's the same thing. He fell down. He crossed the white bar. And since they had selected this area as the punishment zone, they probably were around patrolling. And then they showed up because he went in there. I don't think it was they weren't just there at the time.
I think this explains the whole random nature thing, the random nature of where the mediators patrol. I think you've got it absolutely spot on, because what is the point of randomly travelling to various places to see if a crime is being committed? The best thing to do is to show up just after a crime has been committed. This is why they ask the question of do you freely admit what you've done? Were there any witnesses to this? Because they use that as a test as to whether a crime has been committed or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to say, and they also ran up to the area where it happened, suggesting that they were trying to get there in a hurry. But of course, they run everywhere, so it doesn't actually make a difference. It pains the mediators deeply what it is they have to do, but given the circumstances and the existing canon of laws, they have no other choice. As one of them raises a syringe to inject Wesley, Worf and Yar draw their phasers, and Riker knocks him down to the ground. The mediators are taken aback by this, not knowing why they are not allowed to simply execute the boy. They are disappointed in the Enterprise crew, stating that they thought they had come as friends. Riker tries to contact the Enterprise, but there is still no response. Yeah. So, go on.
No, I was just going to say, they are as surprised and shocked by the Enterprise crew's reaction as the crew was to the fact that they were going to just execute Wesley.
The whole thing seems accepted. The fact that they were just going to inject him and execute him straight away with no process, with no trial, with no they did question him, but with no process. The fact that the Enterprise crew challenged what the mediators were doing. It's probably something that's never happened before. They've never been challenged before because it is the accepted way of doing things.
Absolutely, yes.
But even now, despite the conversation we've just had about why they didn't communicate the laws to people, I'm just surprised that, understanding that they have a seemingly perfect legal system, they have no provision for outsiders. Either for communicating laws to them in advance, or even offering some form of mitigation to say, do you know what? Yeah, it did happen. You've admitted it happened. There are witnesses that saw you do it. They have defended you in saying it was an accident, and it's your first time here. So I tell you what, we'll let you off this time. We'll give you a warning. We'll put a little black mark in our book against your name. Do it again and we'll kill you.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I understand that, that's the core of the story, but yeah, that they should have a society like that should have something like that in place. Yes. And then make Wesley do another mistake.
What? Oh, I see. Actually, trap him.
Yeah, no, but I mean, as the story writers, they could have done what you said, and that would have made a, that would have made a lot of sense. And then, if they wanted, still wanted to have this this kind of storyline, then you know, have him make another another mistake or something weird like that, that you know, Wesley does.
Well, you'd have to, as the way the episode would have finished 20 yeah. minutes early. Back on the Enterprise, the bubble, I thought it was a sphere, but never mind, finishes its information exchange with Data and disappears, leaving him unconscious. At the same time, communication is restored. After being informed of the situation, Captain Picard beams down to the planet.
Yes.
I think it's unusual for Picard to have beamed down to the planet.
Well, he does when there's an officer involved. So Wesley was involved, and so I guess that's why he went down.
Yeah, yeah, I get that.
Like when Yar was abducted a few episodes ago?
Yes.
Now, I have a better question. How did Riker know Beverly was on the bridge when he was talking to Picard, and he cleverly not mentioned Wesley's name when he said, we have a problem with one member of the away team?
Did he know that Beverly was on the bridge, or was he just being completely professional?
Yeah, because okay. Could be.
If you're on a communicator, an audio communicator, you do not know who is listening at the other end.
Okay, yes. But the fact that Beverly was there, it really sounded like he was intentionally avoiding to tell, you know, to name Wesley because she was there. But yeah, you might be right. You're probably right, yes.
She never said anything, did she?
No.
While they were there?
No.
The first communication we heard actually was coming in from the surface.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Yar that was trying to get in contact with them.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I did actually write the question, why didn't they just beam the away team back? But actually, that is answered further down the review.
Yes.
So on to Act 4. Everyone seems as kind as ever when Picard arrives in the council chamber on the planet's surface, and then the dialogue begins. They regret that their system of justice is troubling Picard. Data explains that Wesley is being held, pending the execution of his sentence at sundown, and they stand by their system of justice. They explain the tranquility in their lives has been made possible by their laws, for they are a people of law, even though that may bring them sadness, but which they have adjusted to. Picard makes the argument that when Earth executed criminals, they thought for the longest time that it was necessary to do so, until they learned to detect the seeds of criminal behaviour. Capital punishment is, therefore, no longer considered a justifiable deterrent.
What does he mean by detect the seeds of criminal behavior? Is that like, you know, looking into someone's gene pool and say, oh, you're going to, in 18 years, you will do something bad and we're going to take care of that right now?
A Minority Report.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't think that's what he meant. I think what he was talking about there is the justice system had evolved to the point where you could actually now determine intent.
Okay.
By somebody who had committed a crime. Mm. And that if somebody had killed another human being, there are 500 million different reasons why that could have happened. It could have been out and out murder. It was intent. I went there to kill that person, to deprive them of life. Mm-hmm. At the other end of the scale, I was up a ladder, painting the wall over the outside of my house. The handle on the paint pot broke. The paint pot landed on this person's head and killed them. You've got two opposite ends of the spectrum there. Mm-hmm. One is completely accidental, and the other one is completely not accidental.
You mean the one with the paint pot isn't that?
Yeah,
is the one that is intentional.
Oh, it just broke. But obviously, the punishment for those two crimes needs to be vastly different because of the circumstances, the intent, and such like. Whereas in, I've forgotten the name of their planet now. In the Edo world, it doesn't matter whether it's accidental or whether it was intentional. You die.
Yeah.
So I think that's what Picard meant. I think that's what Picard meant at that point.
Understood.
I'm going to have to go get some water in a minute. Mm-hmm. The Edo's reaction is a little confusing to comprehend, but they do seem to feel that Picard is suggesting some kind of superiority. Since they apparently are not as advanced as they are, Laeta suggests that they just use their superior powers to rescue the boy, stating that they would just record him as a convicted criminal out of their reach, an advanced person who luckily escaped the barbarism of their little backward world.
Yeah.
Gotta tell you, they got sarcasm down.
But I would have done it if I were Picard. We're going to beam Wesley back and...
That's why I asked the question. Why didn't they just yank him out of there?
Yeah. The prime directive and all that.
I didn't realise the prime directive actually prevented them from doing that. But I suppose if by evading their system of justice, you are interfering with their lifestyle, which is a breach of the prime directive.
Absolutely.
So... that situation is an impossible one.
Yeah. Especially with this weird entity in space that they didn't know anything about and didn't know what it wanted from them. So.
No, exactly. Yeah. And in fact, I think it's in the next scene. Mm-hmm. Next but one scene. Yeah. We find out exactly what that entity is doing and the reason why Picard shouldn't have beamed him out. Picard tells the Edo that he wants to honour and respect their rules and law, referencing to them the Prime Directive. He takes the time, since the Edo guarantee Wesley will not be harmed before sundown, to ask about the vessel in orbit. The Edo recognise it as their god, who is said to be somewhere up there, a protector who is far above them, both here and in another place, with great powers. Dr. Crusher calls in and says Data wishes to speak with Picard urgently. Not wanting to involve all of the Edo, and not sure if he can accept the description of God, he beams himself, Counselor Troi, and Reven up to the Enterprise.
Yeah, she was scared, Reven. Understandably, it's probably the first time she was transported from her planet to somewhere else.
Yeah, I did wonder whether there was another reason she was scared, a reason which manifests itself a bit, little bit later on.
Yeah,
but I'm guessing that Picard took Reven with them for a very specific reason. At this point, obviously, I didn't know what was going to happen. But yeah, he took her along to educate her, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Is fair. On the Enterprise, on the way to a room with a window, Reven is amazed at the city in the sky, referring to Enterprise, and is surprised with all that power they didn't just take Wesley.
And yes, when once again there's a suggestion that they could should. Young Wesley out of jail and go away.
Not just that, but she's also suggesting that they should have subverted the laws of their land.
Yeah, as if that happened before, some maybe. As in, someone arrives, okay. stronger than you, and then do, you know, say, okay, I don't care about your laws. I'm going to get my people back and screw you.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know, it just crossed my mind.
No, it's a good theory. It's a good theory. I wasn't sure whether Riven was actually not fully in support of their laws in the first place. At least certainly not in this circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
If she believes, hang on a second, this isn't right, they should just let him go. But she can't say that because that may in itself be a violation of law.
Mm-hmm.
When she sees the object in orbit, Riven kneels down and bows before it immediately, confirming that yes, this is their god. Riven seems to be extremely frightened by the object. Deanna encourages her to explain that she can identify it because it has appeared before. Suddenly, the object then thunders for Picard to return its child and begins moving closer to the Enterprise. Very quickly, Picard attaches his comm badge to Riven and has her beamed back to the planet's surface, and the object moves away.
Not a second too late. Too early? Too early.
Soon. No, too soon, yes.
I'm going to get that right eventually. Not a second too soon.
Yes, on today's English lesson. on today's English lesson, I will learn to speak properly. I think that Picard should be having words with the transporter chief. I mean, you said yourself that that wasn't a moment too soon. But actually, the length of time that the transporter chief, who incidentally wasn't O'Brien.
No.
And I thought O'Brien was the transporter chief, took ages to respond to that call.
Yes, and then when Picard ordered, when he responded and Picard ordered to beam one to the planet, it also took a...
Well, he had to say it twice.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe yeah, a small kicking for that one, I think.
Yeah. No kudos for you.
So that's, no, that's no. Absolutely.
One more kudos in my bag. I take this kudos back.
Well, you have to give it to take it back.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's one I won't give to him and give to someone else.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
I suppose it got hurt in first time.
Someone who deserves it.
That's not me. That's definitely not me. Picard and Dr. Crusher speak about Wesley and her concern that he's about to be executed for committing no crime, certainly not one that any sane or reasonable person would recognise. She tells him that if Wesley were his son, he would be as frightened as she is, to which he responds that he is.
Yeah, so we're back to that strange relationship between Picard and Wesley as maybe a proxy to Jack.
Yes.
Jack. Yeah,
The guilt.
Yes.
Mm. Picard then talks to Data about his experience. When Data regains consciousness, he explains to Picard everything that was communicated to him. Data says that it's not one entity, it is in fact many, and they know that the Edo worship them as a god. Quite expected and harmless at the present Edo stage of evolution. Data also states that the god aliens are interdimensional beings and thus can be in several places at once. And due to this, the Edo gods consider this entire star cluster to be theirs. He then points out the obvious that it was unwise to place a human colony in this star cluster, and then rambles on about potential colonization, until Picard stops him and says, Data, don't babble. Please organize it into brief answers to my questions.
that's my quote of the week, when Data says that I'm not aware I've been babbling, and then goes on babbling about him not babbling.
Yeah. Yeah, that was absolute so classic.
Yeah.
They continue to talk, but briefly, until Data volunteers the information that the Edo God aliens may be observing them now, as they know everything Data knows, including the Prime Directive, and may be watching to see what the Enterprise will do next. Finally, Picard asks how the Edo God aliens would react if they were to violate the Prime Directive, and Data answers that they would consider the Enterprise crew to be deceitful and untrustworthy, and subsequently reminds Picard that the Edo God aliens warned them not to interfere with their children below. Dr. Crusher begins to cry, and Data starts to babble on about the emotion of motherhood when he is abruptly cut off by Crusher, telling him to shut up. It is at this moment that Data realizes that he does, in fact, babble.
Duh.
Recognizing you have a problem is the first step to recovery.
Absolutely.
I thought that was good progress from Data there, actually, self-diagnosis.
Yeah, that was a great scene with this bit of humor and still a very strong scene with Beverly here. Worried, of course, about the fate of Wesley. Great job from the writers on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really struggling to find any bits of this episode that I wasn't particularly happy with. You may have noticed, you know, we're now at the end of Act 4. I have made no complaints.
Yeah. We're going to talk after the review about the episode as a whole.
That sounds really ominous. Okay. Moving on. So on to Act 5, final act. Picard sends for Data to ask more questions as he attempts to try and put together what he knows into some sort of decision. Picard asks Data to help him with this decision, and Data asks in response, "What level of communication, sir?" Picard smiles and says, "Any. My apologies for saying that you babbled. You see things in a way that we do not, but as they truly are."
Yeah, well, it does babble. But, yeah, it's most of the time it's useful and funny.
Yes. Now, in this scene, Picard says something that is totally out of Picard character. He referred to Data as my friend.
Yes. I think it's the first time.
Don't get me wrong. I think it was incredibly, I want to say cute, but that's not the word I want at all. It was incredibly heartfelt from Picard, because I think Picard is starting to recognize that Data is probably as human as he is.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. It's the beginning of the cohesion of the bridge crew. We've already seen that there's chemistry between Riker and Picard, and we know there's a past relationship between Picard and Beverly,
yep,
as you know, the wife of his best friend. Mm-hmm. And now Data is becoming one of Picard's friends, which, by the way, will hold until, you know, Data dies in the last one of the last episodes of Picard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was great. In terms of the friendship and trust between Picard and Data, there is one particular scene later on, which I will pick up on later on in this episode, that kind of illustrates the building of that trust between the two of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Picard is torn between the letter of the law and the knowledge that the Prime Directive never intended to cover a circumstance like this. Data states simply that it is the object he should be worrying about. They know of the Prime Directive, but how will it be viewed is the question. How would they react to taking Wesley, especially with regard to that warning? While pondering these questions, Picard asks if breaking the Prime Directive and saving Wesley's life will potentially endanger the entire Enterprise and the 1,000 people who live on the ship. Data answers his question with, "Would you choose one life over 1,000, sir?" And Picard responds sternly that he refuses to let arithmetic decide questions like that.
I know someone who would have answered that the need of the many outweighs
the need of the few. Absolutely. The few. Although that then did change later on down the line.
But yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't like to be in Picard's shoes.
Absolutely. We said it earlier on. This is an impossible situation.
Yeah.
You've got two opposing sets of laws, both of which were actually intended and designed for good, which will lead to the destruction of one or more lives, whichever way the decision goes.
Yeah.
It is really unfair, and Picard should not be in this situation, but it's kind of his job.
Yeah.
But I the question that Data came out with about choosing one life over 1,000, where would that have come from? That's not logic speaking.
Well, I guess he thinks that if the alien gods see them untrustworthy and you know, just not respecting law and things like that, they would destroy the Enterprise.
Yeah. Oh, no. I get the logistics of it. It was more the fact that he was asking a question of almost a philosophy.
Yeah.
But actually, having thought about it, it is one of logic, that it does not make sense to sacrifice the lives of 1,000-plus people to save one.
Yeah.
Logically.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'd like to say hello to Andrew, who has joined Lainey in the YouTube chat room. Good evening, Andrew.
Good evening, Andrew. The number of live chat viewers did actually just flicker to 4 and then went back to 3 again. So I don't know who the fourth person was.
I think 4 is like an all-time record for us.
Probably is, to be fair.
Nice, and yes, though. Andrew, Data dies eventually.
Spoiler!
Well, we have reviewed this episode on the show, so it's not a spoiler anymore.
Well,
as I consider that once we do something, then the entire world now knows.
Yeah, and I'm sure Andrew watched Picard, didn't he? Oh, no, he didn't review a Picard with us, did he?
Well, if you head to trgreyhot.org and go to the past guests, which is /guests, you can find a list of all our past guests and which episode they were on. So let's have a look.
Is it up to
Andrew
date?
Andrew was with us for Picard Season 1, Episode 3, The End is the Beginning.
Ah. Is that up to date? Am I seeing things?
It is up to date.
Wow. Sorry, I don't mean to sound so surprised, but
yeah, as of last week, I think.
Excellent.
No, not last week, because I don't have Andrew as a guest for TNG, but as of 3 weeks ago.
Hmm. I see the answers aren't up to date then. Anyway, moving
on.
Yeah,
don't push it.
baby steps. Data believes that the multidimensional entity did exist earlier in our dimension, but they're now taking advantage of their present abilities. Perhaps they did share a value system like that of the Federation and existed in some flesh and blood form previously, but in their present multidimensional state, they may have advantages that the others do not understand. Picard wonders if that means they would have previously shared the same values as them. So, why would such an advanced species feel obliged to protect the Edo? Data theorizes that the Edo are a child race that they have chosen to protect, just as the Federation puts down colonies and protects them.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe the alien did something some kind of mistake with the Edo, and now they're trying to protect them, you know, as kind of a, okay, we've made a mistake, we're going to fix that, we're going to protect this planet. Maybe something like that, or maybe it's just a, you know, pet project that just send the few people on this planet and see how they evolved. It could be a lot of things.
That's really good. I hadn't considered that at all. That maybe they're trying to atone for previous mistakes. That they feel a certain what's the word I'm looking for? Obligation towards the Edo. Yeah.
Maybe they even are the ones who you know, put those laws in place, as they were chaos. It was chaos before, and then they arrived, and then they maybe they did something, and then they said, "Okay, here's how you're going to do things now, and we're sorry, and we're going to watch you from above." I don't know. So that's something that crossed my mind when I watched the episode tonight.
There's a small similarity to the entity on Saru's home planet, where there's this overseeing entity that effectively dishes out death, in this case, as part of the natural order of things. It's not the same thing, I get, but there's a certain similarity.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Interesting dialogue. Something that Data said that I think might have been a scriptwriting error. He said, "I could feel that whatever they are now, they once existed in this dimension just as we do, perhaps in the same flesh and blood form."
Yeah.
But Data said that.
Yeah. I was going to say that. Yeah. It's strange because he's not flesh and blood.
Precisely. So either that's an error in script writing, a recognition by Data that actually he is a minority amongst a ship full of flesh and blood beings, or he effectively forgot that he was an android.
Yeah.
In the moment of the conversation.
I would go with script error.
It's easier, isn't it?
Although I don't know how much the actors have their say in this, but you know, if there's something like that, you know, as an actor playing an android, you should probably say, "There's something wrong with your guys. Maybe you could rewrite that or something." I don't know if they didn't have their say in the script, and he just had to read the lines. We have to keep in mind that it's episode 7. So I don't know if Brent Spiner did something before Star Trek Next Gen, if he was known that, for anything else.
Yeah, so that's a good question, because if he's fairly new in the big time, then he might not feel he could challenge the direction or the script writers at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
But all in all, that particular scene was incredibly good. So maybe the director thought, "Do you know what? We'll let this go because I don't want to have to shoot it again, and we'll end up with something that's not as good."
Yeah.
When Dr. Crusher arrives, Picard preempts her request to beam down to the planet and approves it. He has also made the decision. He will not allow the Edo to execute Wesley, regardless of the cost. Picard simply states that he will ensure that Wesley will not be executed, but in a way everyone will agree upon. Picard and Crusher head towards the transporter, but not before Picard hands command of the Enterprise to Data. That was the element of trust that I was talking about earlier. Picard didn't even think about it. He just immediately said, "You have command."
Yes. Can I be picky on that?
Please.
So he hands over command of the Enterprise to Data in the observation lounge, with no witness and no official record. So
yeah, okay.
I mean, I can imagine Data coming on the bridge and say, "Hey, I'm the boss now." So, yeah, what? We didn't get the memo.
Well, they wouldn't need to be, because the crew would know that Picard is no longer on the ship. Data,
yeah, well,
probably. Data would be the ranking officer.
I imagine the Data, computer is listening anyway. So,
No, LaForge is on the planet, isn't he?
No, he's in, on the bridge.
So, would it be Data or LaForge that is ranking officer?
Data is already commander.
Oh, right, okay.
And LaForge is
lieutenant. Lieutenant. Yeah.
So,
fair enough. Picard also states the impact of breaking the law of the Prime Directive, which states that they must not interfere with other lives in the galaxy, and that by doing so, by saving Wesley, he will be breaking that law. Risking the wrath of God and the Federation when he returns, he gives the order to beam up. Nothing happens. God has prevented their escape.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah.
That was kind of like, I'm sure there was a scene in Picard where a similar thing happened, where he called to be beamed up, and it's like, whenever you're ready, anytime you like.
Anytime now. Yeah. He said that he would prevent Wesley from being executed in a way that the Edo understand, but I'm not sure they understood anything, as in, well, understood the words, yes, but not the intent and the consequences. So, yeah, it just, so far, it just, doing what they suggested he do, that's taking Wesley by force and then, leaving them. They would pretend that he escaped, but I'm not sure, they wouldn't agree to that.
No, with no pun intended, what Picard has suggested would have been completely alien to them.
Yeah.
Because of how they blindly believe in their laws and justice system. So, Picard never would have made them understand what it was he did. No. Well, tried to do, should I say.
Yeah. That didn't work.
The Edo are vindicated. Picard then shouts up to the ceiling that there can be no justice as long as laws are absolute. He elaborates that laws such as these, without degrees of punishment and with such severe consequences, cannot be just. He argues that rules should also have exceptions, and that rules with no exceptions can never be just. Just then, the transporter works.
Yes, and did you notice that he was still speaking while being transported?
Not the first time that's happened. I've seen that, I think, in every series or film series I have seen, that has happened in almost every case. However, there was... it was one of the films where... It might have been the Undiscovered Country, where Kirk was being beamed off the surface of Rurapente, I think it was, with Bones. And he started talking as he was being beamed up, and it kind of went all echoey and robot-y. And then as he reformed on the transporter pad on the Enterprise, he started he was still like ranting as he rematerialized. And it kind of robot-y, wavery, kind of voicery appeared. But in this case, it just sounded like he was talking normally.
Yeah. Well, if you can suspend disbelief for a moment and accept that it could be transported, then surely that must be a problem with speaking while being transported, because some of your vocal cords
are in the ether.
Being reformed on the platform while some other parts are still there, and then your lungs are probably gone and can't push air through the vocal cords and stuff like that. So, yeah, even if you accept the transport thing, it's hard to accept that you could still talk while being transported.
Well, strictly speaking, then, if at the point of the start of transport to the end of transport, you're essentially dead.
Yeah.
Clinically, if not, absolutely.
Yes.
I don't know. When they return to the ship, Picard hails the object to inform them that they are leaving and that the colony will be removed at its signal. It dematerializes, which is enough for Picard, although he would have liked the chance to learn more about it.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay. Finn, go ahead with the end of the review.
I say I've only got one line to go.
Yeah.
With Wesley's life saved, the Enterprise departs.
Yeah, so I didn't understand if that was a signal, the fact that the entity disappeared, if it was a signal that they should remove the colony or just a signal that, yeah, okay, that you can leave them there. We've seen that you're good people. That's good.
I don't know why he was waiting for a signal. I would have thought that the removal of the colony would have been an act of good faith anyway. You just go ahead and do it.
Yeah, but do they really have to do it? I mean, the entity let them leave the planet and disappeared. And to me, it was the other way around. They recognized that Picard was right, saying that laws shouldn't be as strict as that, and that they are actually good people. So I understood that as a signal to leave the colony and not to remove it.
But we don't know they did actually remove it. That wasn't actually said.
No, we don't. We don't know. That's true. So what I think is happening now is that they wouldn't remove the colony. That the entity didn't give a clear signal that they should remove the colony.
Hang on a second. It's a different star system.
Is it?
Yes. So the colony they planted was in the, I can't remember what they're supposed to say, Strand or Stranad solar system. But the planet that the Edo were on was in the adjoining Rubicon star system.
Right. So it's a good thing that we have our resident astronomer in the YouTube chat room, because Data said that the entity considers the star cluster to be their own. So is a star cluster something different than a star system? And is it bigger? Does a star cluster include star systems?
Yeah, it does say stellar cluster.
So we're just waiting for the lag between the live show and the YouTube chat, and maybe we're going to have an answer from Andrew.
Well, I think you'll get an answer before I do.
Moving.
Yeah. the Stranad solar system was located inside a stellar cluster containing 3,006 planets that were suitable for colonization.
There we go.
The Rubicon star system has exactly the same description.
Andrew says that a star cluster is a group of stars that were born together.
Right, so Stranad and Rubicon.
Yes,
were two stars of which they are talking about a Class M planet within each of the solar systems. Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense then.
Which makes sense, as a Class M planet should be around the size of the Earth at around the reasonable distance from the Sun.
The comparative distance, yeah, because obviously if the star is like five times the size of Sun, it will need to be slightly further away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, unless you want your bacon burned. Now, I have a complaint.
Okay. It's about time.
It's not a complaint. It's just an observation. Right at the very end, Picard says, "Take us out of here, number one." Riker says, "Gladly, sir." The ship moves away. Number one, Riker did nothing. He didn't give an order. He didn't press any buttons.
That's true.
Secondly, why did Picard delegate this doing of nothing to Riker in the first place when he could have said, Mr. LaForge, take us out?
Yes.
Why would you give it to your number one?
Because if there's a mistake made in this nothing, then the captain is not to blame for that. For not doing nothing properly.
That's harsh. So by saying take us out of here, number one, he's effectively absolving himself of all blame for whatever happens in the action of taking us out of here.
Yes.
Excellent. Makes perfect sense.
That's probably, you know, routine orders, like, you know, heading 123.56 and speed 9, warp 9 something, and, you know, so boring stuff goes to the first officer.
Yes.
Yeah, so this episode is not bad. It's far from being bad. It's just a bit silly, you know, that when they arrive on that planet, you're like, what's going on? Why are they running around in their underwear, basically?
Because they're happy.
Yes, but in fact, it's a story about law and you know, respecting law, the law, and what Picard said at the end, that a system of justice that is not flexible, that does not have exceptions, is not just system. So there is a very strong message in this episode. The whole Edo are just a bit silly. And I thought it was, maybe it took something out of the story by bringing this element of distraction. I'm pretty sure they could have done the exact same episode with a people that was not running around half naked and you know, just doing engaging in pleasurable activities.
Yeah, sort of unbridled hedonism. But the lifestyles of the Edo was completely incidental to the storyline. It had no impact on the direction of the storyline at all. Yeah. It was just a quirk of an alien race. Every alien race that has ever been depicted on Star Trek has always had some form of quirk. Something that sets them apart, something that you can look back and say, Edo, oh yes, they were the ones that basically did it all day. So it's just something to remember them by, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose. I remember that when I watched that episode previously, when I started watching this episode tonight in preparation of this show, I was like, oh, no, not this episode again. Like, you know, it happens with some of those episodes that you don't want to watch again. But then, I don't know if I didn't pay enough attention when I watched it earlier this year, when I started rewatching every episode, or if maybe I was in a better mood tonight. I don't know. But I actually enjoyed it tonight as being a good episode with a good storyline.
Yeah, no, I definitely appreciated it. It was a good episode. couple of bits of trivia regarding the episode. This was actually the first script to be submitted for the pilot of The Next Generation.
Would it have been a good pilot?
Sorry, I have just completely misread that. This was the first script that was submitted after the pilot episode.
Oh,
so
okay.
This should have been the first episode after the pilot. Sorry.
Which would have been in place of Yesterday's Enterprise?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it would have been better than Yesterday's Enterprise.
But would it have been? Because the observations we've made over the last few weeks about the production quality, that had they produced this episode after Encounter at Farpoint, then the production quality may not have been as good.
Yeah, and the whole thing with Wesley, after the pilot, it was maybe too soon to bring that with. It's good that it's there. And yeah. It's a gain in quality compared to last week, and we're going to have a good episodes from now on. I think if I remember correctly, they're getting pretty good now.
Mm. Another piece of trivia: this is the first episode to feature shots on location since Encounter at Farpoint.
Okay.
All the previous ones had been on the Enterprise.
And to answer a question from Andrew, no, they didn't specify that it was an open cluster or a closed cluster as opposed to open. So we don't know if it's an open star cluster or not.
Not a clue.
Not this Scooby.
And finally, on the trivia side, I did notice actually that a lot of the storyline, a lot of the words had been overdubbed, particularly in the scenes on the planet. You could definitely see that some of the lip syncing was off. And it sounded like the quality of the audio was off. And apparently, where they recorded those locations shots was in the northern part of Los Angeles, and it was right under the flight path of Van Nuys Airport. So there were airplanes flying overhead all the time. So they had to redub a lot of the scenes to remove the sounds of the aircraft, which wouldn't have worked having aircraft flying overhead at all.
No.
But yeah, no, I liked it. It was a good episode. I think it's probably one of the best, if not maybe the second best, of the eight that we've seen so far.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. I haven't noticed any bad acting, although some parts with Beverly Crusher gets McFadden. Maybe not 100%, but. But yeah, overall, a very good episode. Yeah. Very well played. Even Wesley, what's his name?
Will Wheaton.
Will Wheaton. Even Will Wheaton did play properly. Mm. I guess he's getting better now.
He's in it a lot more.
Yeah.
He has an active part in the series a lot more.
And probably getting used to being an actor too.
Yeah, I would have thought so.
Mm-hmm.
Right, well, unless there's anything else, I think that brings to the end our review of Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 1, Episode 8, Justice.
Okay, so this past weekend, as we record this, so it was, 30th of May, the SpaceX Dragon capsule, Endeavour, docked with the International Space Station. That was an awesome mission and fantastic coverage that we could follow on YouTube, on many channels like SpaceX Channel or NASA TV and things like that. But I realized, you know, that's the reality, and we if I was involved in that, but as a human race, we sent a spaceship. In space with two people in there. And that's what we do every week on Star Trek. And I was thinking, we are still far away from the fiction. So the reality doesn't match at all. I mean, they took 19 hours from Earth to reach the International Space Station. 4 hours to open the hatch for the guys to get out of the spaceship to get into the space station. So, I mean, in science fiction, we can travel to the other side of the universe at warp speed and then beam to a new planet. So we still have a few steps to do before we can reach, an era, even the Enterprise era where there was no transport and things like that.
No, but the ability to travel from A to B, docking speeds, literally throwing a spaceship into the orbit of a planet, bearing in mind that Enterprise was only 130 years from now.
Yes.
And Next Generation is best part of 350 years ahead. So, yeah, it's... I get what you're saying. And actually, if you look at the two situations, you look at the reality of what we're seeing, and I really wish I'd seen more of the SpaceX launch than I did, and that of what we've been seeing in The Next Generation, that we've seen in Enterprise, it is quite amazing that we could potentially be at, well, I won't be here, but we could potentially be at that stage in 130 years where we are traveling to different stars and different universes.
I
watched the original run of Cosmos, the series that Carl Sagan did back in the 1980s. One of the things that he said was, it is amazing that we can travel to different stars and different star systems. Maybe not in person, but at the moment we can do it through mechanics and electronics fairly easily, and we've been doing it for decades. So if you think about where we were in, was it the 1950s, one of the first times we sent something up into space?
Sputnik?
I think that was 1950s, wasn't it? Was it early 60s? Yeah. Can't remember.
Something like that.
You know, we're now 60 years ahead of that at this point in time. And the advancements we've made in that time, obviously, it has been spoiled by the fact that when the space shuttle was decommissioned and the NASA space program was halted, was it 9 years ago, I think it was?
Yes, 9 years.
That we've not been able to do anything in the meantime. Just think, if they hadn't stopped the space program in 2011, where would we be now?
Yeah.
You've got the European Space Agency doing amazing things. You've got the, what do they call it? The Russian Space Agency doing amazing things. Mm-hmm. All over the world, people are doing things to try and get this into space. You've even got the US military.
With
Space Force, which, by the way, is also a series on Netflix that we're going to start watching very soon. It looks hilarious. So, you know, space travel and space exploration is being taken seriously again in our reality, which is, it's a good time to be here.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, there's a program to send humans on the moon again, and then they are getting ready to send another probe or something on Mars. With Elon Musk getting into the business of space, and now, I mean, I was amazed at something that's, for all those years, NASA sent rockets into space, and they just wasted the first stage of each rocket, and now there's a commercial entity coming into play, and the first thing they do is design a rocket where they can reuse the first stage.
Exactly.
I mean, it changes the everything, because now they're it's a commercial entity, so they are going to do that for money, but they also are going to invest in technologies that they can reuse, and so by losing less money on those things, they can invest more money and then maybe push forward what they can do. And it was, the whole thing was amazing. I watched the launch from, I turned the video when, a few minutes before the launch, and I watched it, you know, go up in space, and then it was really good for Europe, the timing, because it launched on the, was it the Saturday night?
Yes.
yes, around 9 p.m. or something like that here in Switzerland. And then the docking was around 4 p.m. the next day. So very, very good timing for Europe. And I watched the docking. I didn't watch the whole, you know, opening the hatch thing because I thought it was going to take like half an hour, but it took 4 hours to open the door. So yeah, amazing to the technologies that the fact that the Dragon capsule was moving 0.1 meter per second to approach the space station and was able to stay in sync with the space station and hold at 20 meters from the space station for a last check and everything had to work perfectly and it did. It was I understand that it was a showcase for SpaceX. So that's why we had the whole coverage for 24 or 30 hours. But it is amazing. I was in awe. And the interesting thing is that on the Friday night, Zoe didn't want to sleep. She was upset. She didn't want to sleep. So I took her with me in the office, and I just turned on. I saw a link that someone posted on Telegram about the rocket being ready to launch. So I turned that on, and she started asking questions. So why? Well, so she knew what a rocket was, but then she asked, why is it burning? Why is it the fire that pushes the rocket? Why is the first stage going back down and
wow.
Stuff like that? Yeah, and she seemed interested. And then the next day, we saw the guys in the space station, you know, flying around, getting ready for the crew for the SpaceX crew to get in. And so she told me, I want to go to space because I want to be able to fly.
Oh, bless her. Yeah.
I told her that was not easy. And then she started almost crying, saying, well, you always wanted to go to space and we never went. And I was like, yeah, well, that's not going to happen. Not tomorrow anyway.
Bless. I mean, regardless of what you may think of Elon Musk as an individual, as a human being, you've got to admit that the work that SpaceX is doing to advance not just space travel, but also the work it's doing with the Skylink satellites is quite admirable. But I have to say this. I honestly and sincerely hope that as part of the efforts to push further into space, that will also include cleaning up what's already up there. Because the amount of satellites that SpaceX is throwing up into the ether at the moment, and I think it's numbered in the thousands, isn't it? It's how many he's trying to get up there to build this satellite-based broadband system, is absolutely huge. And if you look up there at the moment, there's an app or a website somewhere that actually shows you exactly how much debris there is up there in the various atmospheric layers and out in orbit and beyond. And it is shocking how much space debris there actually is up there that has been put there by us.
Yes.
And if something isn't done with it soon, it's only going to get worse, and it's going to get to the point where it's actually going to start affecting us down here on Earth.
Yeah.
So I say this now, Elon, if you're listening to this, if you're consuming this content, you're listening to what we're saying, can you just like hoover up a bit up there before you throw something else into the sky? Thanks, mate.
I would imagine as a commercial entity, it would, if you can, you know, grab those satellites, bring them back and put them back to use, that's what he's going to do. Same thing he did with the reusable first stage of the SpaceX rocket. I don't remember the name of the rocket, but it just makes sense.
It's different though, because that's his property.
Yeah, well, those well, you know, if there's a business to do bringing back satellites from other people, and it's a business opportunity. He is a businessman. If there's a business up there I'm sure we'll find a way to make a few bucks out of it.
Oh, absolutely. If there's some cash to be made, then hopefully it'll
Andrew says Sputnik was in 1957.
Yeah, I thought it was in the 1950s. Yeah, no, it's brilliant. So 57, 60 to 63 years,
mm-hmm.
which is quite phenomenal. Older than me, anyway.
Absolutely.
Cool. Okay, so we want to give a huge shout out to a member of our team that isn't just myself and Yannick. So our good friend Lainey, who is a longtime friend of this show and others, and is also one of the founder members of the Other Side Podcast Network, has been, I can't say promoted because you have to have been something beforehand, but she is our new social media manager. So she'll be taking care of our Twitter and Facebook, presumably, because we do have a Facebook page. We don't promote it because we don't keep it up to date. So hopefully now that we have a social media manager, it will get kept up to date for us. So thank you very much indeed, Lainey, for agreeing to do that for us.
Yes. Yeah, so as soon as I give Lainey the rights to manage the Facebook page, she will start posting things. So if you're a Facebook user, we will give you the link to the page as soon as possible. We would also like to thank our Patreon patrons. Those people help us financially. So if you want to, if you feel like helping us, it's up to you. Listening to our show is already huge. But you can head over to patreon.com/TEGH podcast. And we would like to thank Cubicle Nate, our good friend Nate, my co-host on on Maker's Corner, and also Rufus, who is our second Patreon. Thank you, guys. It's really an honor to have you as our patron.
Yeah, it's nice to have a little bit of support and assistance for keeping the show running. We will never prevent you from listening. We won't offer people that don't pay a lesser service. Whether you pay or not, you'll get the same service. So
I actually most of the time forgot to post on Patreon. So
I'm collecting the money.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, guys.
Excellent. Right, so I think if that's everything, then I think we should close down.
Yes.
So thank you to everybody who has downloaded our previous episodes. We do appreciate you spending what is probably very valuable time at the moment to listen to our show and support us. You can help us spread the love for our show by petitioning Elon Musk to put the address of our website on the side of all of his Dragon 2 spacecraft on their next expedition so that all of the telescope owners of the Earth can see it if they look really, really closely. Or if that sounds really too expensive, you can simply post our website address on social media.
Our website, which is tlgreyhut.org, where you can find our show notes, our reviews, leave a comment for every episode, look at the schedule, look at our past guests, and maybe someday you will have a page with the answer to our 7 questions that has been updated. Who knows? Everything can happen.
Indeed. And you can, of course, send us an email if you wish to. Our address is feedback@tlgreyhot.org. We do read everything that we receive. We love to hear from you. And I would also say that if there is anything you would like to contribute towards the show in terms of your own answers to the 7 questions, if you want to contribute a suggestion for how we do the spread your love for the show bit towards the end of the show, or anything else that you want to contribute towards the show, send us it. If we like it, we'll use it and we'll give you credit for it.
Absolutely. You can also ping us on Twitter. We are at TEGH podcast, and we are also on Telegram at t.me/TEGH podcast. And that's the only place where you will get the link to our unlisted live stream. live stream is what people do when they watch us record this show.
Yes. Thank you, as always, to the phenomenal Memory Alpha. We have based our review of this week's episode on their work, and that is released under a Creative Commons by attribution, non-commercial license.
The rest of the show is released under a Creative Commons by attribution share-alike license. You can see our website for details.
This podcast is a part of the Other Side Podcast Network. Find out more of our phenomenal shows over at otherside.network.
And our next episode will be a review of Star Trek The Next Generation Season 1, Episode 9, The Battle. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thank you, Dave, once again for joining me on this little show that we do.
My pleasure. I've got to say, I really am still, even after 43 recordings, I'm still absolutely loving this. It's I'll be honest, I wasn't 100% sure whether this is something that I could maintain because, you know, it is weekly. It does take time out, but if I'm honest, it's worth it.
Yeah.
If only to stare at your face.
I would have expected that would be the least interesting unit of the show, but...
Well, if you're listening to this, join our Telegram group, get our YouTube link, and find out for yourself how wonderful it is to stare at Yannick's face.
Oh, well, I guess it's time to end this show. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Lainey and Andrew, for joining us in the live chat room. We will be back next week with a whole bunch more of Star Trek. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Ciao, ciao.
See ya. Nevertheless, Riker has Troy head outside to look. Laeta explains that Wesley is being held pending the execution of his sentence and feel that said worship is quite expect. Take three. Which states that they must not interfere with other lives. And I think that's a really good point.
Yes.
You've been listening to a member of the Other Side Podcast Network. Find more about our shows at otherside.network.